Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. On this episode, what you're going to hear is a conversation I have with president of Stripe, Will Gabrick. Will has had a very interesting career, going from an early job at Blackstone while working on his math PhD to Yale Law School to working as a software engineer before ultimately joining Thrive, where he was a general partner and led the investment in Stripe, before going over to Stripe, where he initially started as CFO, then became chief product officer, and now works as president. Will and I talk about a number of different things, including his career arc and how he made each of the decisions along the way, as well as what he looked for in his time as a venture capitalist and what ultimately led him to making the decision to join the Stripe team today. We also then talk about artificial intelligence and where they're using that within Stripe and also where he sees it going forward. Finally, we talk about the motivations and the things that keep him going today and what makes his job at Stripe enjoyable. A really fun conversation that you'll hear with Will now.
Well, Will, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you've had an interesting career path. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure I get this right. So you studied math at Harvard. Mm-hmm. Then you went and you were doing a PhD in math?
I was, yeah. I was actually at Blackstone working in private equity at the same time. And then twice a week, I would come down to the Kront Institute NYU and take classes and then go back to my cube and, you know, work all night. And
time management maybe will be one of my questions in a second. But then you were a software engineer.
Yeah.
And then from there, you went to Yale Law School.
Yeah. Actually, fun fact, my first boss as a software engineer was Chris Dixon.
Oh, funny.
Yeah.
At Hunch. Chris Dixon of crypto Web3
exactly.
fame these days.
Yeah.
Then did you finish Yale Law School?
I did. I'm actually a proud and completely incompetent member of the New York Bar.
Oh, that's amazing.
Today, yeah.
So then Thrive,
mm-hmm.
and now Stripe,
yeah.
As you're making these professional career decisions along the way, how did you think about like mm-hmm. what to do next?
So I'm a big believer in career construction via induction. I think there's like a lot of career engineering you can do. Like, I want to get to here. And it's a classic sort of MBA approach of, if I want to be here when I'm 45, then what do I need to do today? At every point, just you meet people, you see opportunities, you work your butt off. And when something seems really interesting and you're really compelled by people, you can jump on it. So Thrive, Josh Kosher and I did not know each other. In college, we were 1 year apart, and I was going to work as an engineer at a startup during the summer of, I guess, my second year of law school, and just got a cold email from Josh saying, hey, I'm sort of doing this venture thing, you want to get together? And incidentally said, I need a CTO for my fund. And so my original job at Thrive was to be CTO of the fund, and we were three people. It was, you know, a $5 million fund working out of just a random tiny office in one of the Kushner buildings. And it turned out, you know, Thrive didn't actually need a CTO. It needed, you know, someone who could do deals. And so pretty quickly pivoted to doing that. And that was awesome. Loved Thrive. Just amazed by what that crew has done. Some of my best friends over there. And I left Thrive to go to Stripe, you know, similarly just because of, you know, it just sort of landed on my plate as an opportunity. I'd been at Thrive for about 5 years. I'd led an investment round in Stripe. I think it was a Series C or something like that. It was a $3 billion valuation, or three and a half. And maybe 6 months later, I was out at like a bar in the East Village with a friend of mine and got a text from Patrick saying, hey, do you want to be CFO? And weird, like what a strange proposition. And I, you know, sort of replied rather impulsively saying, I think that's a very bad idea. but, you know, Patrick is very often a couple steps ahead of me. So we talked about it for a while. I remember his, because I was, you know, being vulnerable and saying, hey, Patrick, like I'm not, you know, I've never worked in finance besides being briefly an analyst in private equity. And he said, well, John and I think we could do it. And maybe I just took that as a challenge or something like that, but jumped over a CFO. And now it's been going on 9 years.
It's funny. Yeah. Some of those things that take a long time of like Yale Law School.
Mm-hmm.
That was no short period of time.
Yeah.
I'm sure Blackstone was a very consuming
yeah.
thing to be doing. Also taking a PhD in math on the side.
Like, yeah.
were you, in both of those decisions to do that incremental thing, were you thinking, hey, this will come in handy to some career end? Or were you doing it for the ends of itself, that it was like something that you actually just found fascinating?
Yeah, really the latter. I get pretty excited about things, and I can't really sort of get myself to stop thinking about them. So when I was at law school, for example, I kept my apartment in New York City and was going back and forth. I was at Yale for law school, so I was in New Haven. And by my third year, I was mostly just going because I had started something called Hack Yale. First couple of years of law school, some like Yale undergrads had gotten wind of the fact that I was an engineer. And when I was an undergrad at Harvard, it was like this, you know, early boom time of building startups at Harvard. None of that culture was at Yale when I was there for law school. So this is late 2000s, you know, 5 years after, you know, Facebook had been started. And I started getting these like cold email pitches from undergrads saying like, hey, I have this idea. Do you want to like found this company with me and so on? And, you know, sort of thinking to myself like, no, like, I don't know you. Maybe, I don't know. What I decided was, hey, what if I taught these kids to, well, these you know, young people to build things? You know, I've been an engineer for a little while. So I decided to start something called Hack Yale, which initially was just me and a whiteboard and like, you know, five kids who sort of had written to me, just teaching them like full stack JavaScript. You know, if you're going to teach them one language, a bit of HTML, you can do things on the client, do things on the server. And, you know, the second class, it was sort of like standing room only in the classroom. Couldn't hold a third one because it was just too packed. So I opened applications at Yale to sort of join this class. And in a week, a third of the student body applied to take it, which was sort of, I think, an incredible signal of the demand for sort of like learning on campus, learning computer science on campus. So I got really excited about that and actually spent like most of my third year of law school just doing that. Huh. So just, you know, I don't know, get excited, you know, spend time on these things.
Did you ever try to use your law degree in pre- I mean, you actually took the bar exam, which I'm told is not a a small endeavor. So did you, was there ever a thought that, hey, I should use this in some capacity or?
Never really. You know, I dropped out of my math PhD program. I just had this itch to, you know, I don't know, do some more school. I really liked it. I mean, it was, you know, freaking expensive. I remember, you know, working in the library to sort of, you know, make sure I could, you know, buy dinner for myself during law school. But never thought I'd use it. There's a great loophole where as long as you're not practicing, you don't have to do the continuing legal education work. So I don't think I'll ever use it, but I loved law school. I learned a lot.
Any of those experiences that you think have been most helpful to your job today at Stripe?
It's probably a good fit with my background to some extent because Stripe is a very polymathic company.
Yeah.
You know, as a venture capitalist, I, you know, had the opportunity to sit on a bunch of boards of SaaS companies. And I remember thinking, you know, wow, we got to like build all this stuff for the company to be successful and they have to ship this new feature and this new thing and so on. And wow, it's so cool they're making all this progress. And when I think about how simple it was just to ship software at a SaaS company, I feel very jealous at Stripe because at Stripe, it's sort of like, okay, we're kicking off this initiative. We need to think about what are the financial crimes mitigation implications here? Are we creating credit risk? Are we licensed in the ways we need to be? Do we have the partners lined up? You know, partnerships like, you know, financial institutions will take many quarters to line up. So this sort of polymathic background of being able to dig in on, you know, anything from the shape of the product and technical designs all the way over to very high level sense of the legal framework has, I think it's paid dividends.
As you think about learning things that benefit you with Stripe, as well as, I don't know, I mean, being able to learn as well as you have across a bunch of different fields, do you have any interesting techniques or ways of learning and getting up to speed in new areas? I was listening to a Yale talk you did in 2015. Yeah. And at that point, you were talking about AI as a field almost 10 years ago. And so I assume you were doing things back then to realize the opportunity that artificial intelligence could present. So I'm curious, are there any techniques or ways of learning that you think are interesting?
Well, I'll tell you a new one for me, which I'm behind the curve on, is YouTube.
Yeah.
Like I was just spending a bunch of time trying to understand how the heck transformers work. And I don't mean like, how do they work? Because no one knows how they work. There's some sort of, you know, black box alien technology, but just like literally, you know, the architecture of it. And it is amazing, just like what you can learn from watching a few 10-minute videos. Besides that, you know, as an engineer, I just really like to take things in, you know, via reading. Just, you know, back in the day, learned a lot of just how to do like actual sort of like commercial programming via Stack Overflow and things like that. Yeah, I read a ton. Oh, actually, a good one. So my partner, Emily, and I have a 2-year-old now. Just audiobooks, you know, when I had to, you know, walk around with her sleeping on my shoulder forever, just like ripping through audiobooks. And that's been great.
Yeah, it's amazing. I also think YouTube, for everyone knows it, but I still think it's underappreciated for how yes. powerful of a medium it is. I had a friend ask me like what the best books were and getting up to speed on real estate investing.
Yeah.
I was like, just go Google or yes. go YouTube, search it for the next, you yes. can spend 6 hours and yeah. you'll get it distilled down in a much easier yeah. way and sort yeah. of present it easily yeah. and all that.
And structurally it makes sense because you watch these videos and you're like, this is clearly a great business for these creators.
100%.
Because I'm sitting through those ads and I'm just like riveted waiting for the next totally. Section, you know?
So yeah.
It just
YouTube
works.
Subscription, by the way, the premium yeah. is actually some of the best money I spend on avoiding those okay. those ads. Just I spend so much time on it and yeah. That benefit I think is well worth whatever I pay. I don't know what it actually even costs. Looking back on your career, I guess, and then we'll move off career, but were these decisions like calculated risks in how you were thinking about them? Like, were you building pro and con sort of trade-off, you know, T-charts or thinking through probabilities of outcomes and whether or not it was going to be successful? Or were you just moving forward into what felt right?
You know, last time I made a big move like this, I guess I was 29.
You know, and that would be Stripe?
That'd be Stripe, yeah. Or I guess, yeah, just turning 30 at the time. And so didn't have that much to lose at that yeah. point. You know, it was hard to walk away from Thrive, mostly because of the relationships and just, you know, we were building something really fun together. But no, nothing has been, you know, too sort of, I don't know, forecasted or risk weighted in
yeah.
the past.
I want to talk about Stripe, but in leaving Thrive, I'm curious as a self-loathing venture capitalist, like what elements of the job do you miss and mm-hmm. what are things that you were, you know, that you're glad you don't have to do anymore?
Yeah. So what I miss? Okay. So, you know, on this thread of being sort of polymathic, just getting to dip your toes into so many fields was amazing. You know, you and I were talking a second ago about like, what's going on in nuclear these days? I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, you know, I get to every now and then read a little something about it.
Yeah.
But you have this license to just learn so much as a venture capitalist. You know, flip side of that was you learn a lot, but you don't actually get to sort of drive results. And, you know, sometimes I just would really want to get my hands dirty. And with Stripe, for example, I was like, you know, kind of getting jealous of they're building this awesome stuff. And, you know, I'd love to get, you know, get to do something like that. And, you know, ended up getting the opportunity to. I know there's lots of things at lots of firms, like internal firm politics and things like that. Fortunately, we didn't have that at Thrive. Such
yeah.
a tight partnership. And I guess maybe the other one, venture capital, you get to meet a lot of people. And that's great. You know, you get to, everyone wants to talk to a venture capitalist.
Yeah.
That was my experience.
Yeah. So Stripe, I guess, you came in as CFO mm-hmm. and the company was about how big? How many people?
I think I was employee 290 something.
Okay.
And probably net of, you know, attrition, probably 250 people at the company.
And so then you stayed on as CFO for longer than I think was originally planned. I guess when you originally joined, was CFO always going to be an on-ramp into doing product-related stuff? Or was that something that you decided along the way?
Yeah, you know, I've never actually directly asked Patrick this, but I think CFO is kind of the job he had to give
yeah.
that I might take.
Yeah.
So I took it. When in 2015, and then in 2018, became chief product officer.
Along with CFO.
Yeah, along with CFO. You know, it's funny, back then I was more fashionable and more tighter jeans. And one of our employees used to joke, I have CFPO, chief fashion pants officer.
That's
that stuck around straight yeah. for a while. And then, you know, about 2 years ago, I moved into this president role.
You did the dual for a while, and then president happened after you shed CFO. Is that
right?
Oh,
yeah. Sorry about that. Skipped a step. We then hired a CFO about 4 years ago, and then now we have a different CFO as of about a year ago.
Okay. And so from a functional standpoint, what rolls up into the president title now?
So from a functional standpoint, a lot of just day-to-day running of the company. So product engineering, we have a separate infra engineering group under our CTO, company operations, you know, from GTM operations to product operations, risk, partnerships, professional services, a lot of things like that. And then, you know, so the job description day-to-day is just make the business successful.
Yeah.
You know, John and Patrick run the company, and I think day-to-day they look to me to do a lot of just sort of running the business.
Yeah, got it. So I guess over the course of the last, 18 months, 2 years, like when is this shift sort of happened from more growth to the balance of growth and profitability? When did that happen?
2022.
Probably.
Yeah.
Were there things you did as a part of that process that you would recommend just as good operational hygiene for companies that maybe think they're operating at, I don't know, 90% as skinny as they should be, but, you know, sort of thinking of the other knobs that they can turn?
Yeah, well, so it's interesting because up until the COVID bonanza, we ran on a principle that we would always be cash flow positive. Now, I actually don't think that's wise advice for a lot of companies, you know, particularly if you are sort of a classic, you know, enterprise company and you have very good foreseeability and you're sort of like, you know, 2 to 3 year LTV on sales and marketing or return on LTV to CAC over 2 to 3 years on sales and marketing. You know, in that case, you actually might want to dip into, you know, spending a bunch of cash, burning cash. But we always decided to run the business actually cash flow positive. Then along came COVID and, you know, there was sort of a harrowing moment where, you know, it looked like the company was going to just stop growing altogether. And then growth just went, you know, through the roof. And, you know, I don't know, you know, drank the Kool-Aid or whatever analogy you want to say around sort of really investing at that time. And it's the first time we dipped into burning cash. You know, interestingly, to date, we've still never burned a dollar of investor money because we had accrued so much cash from operations to that point that even we started burning cash, you know, our cash pile never dipped into like needing outside capital. But two things happened at that point. One was the median average tenure of employees sort of fell off a cliff. You know, when you're growing year on year, like 100% headcount, that means the median person at the company has been there for 6 months or less.
Yeah, and probably like, less when you factor in attrition.
Exactly. And that's just sort of you know, terrifying if you think about it. And the other was, you know, we just related. We didn't see the productivity gains that you would think of, like we're adding, you know, as much capacity as we already have. We should be able to go faster, and it just, you know, didn't play out that way. I think there's some like pretty deep points around capital allocation in this. Like there's some kind of like dangerous correlations or dichotomies that people make. You know, there's the classic one around, you know, speed and resourcing, like. Or features and resourcing, like I can give you A, B, and C if you give me more people. And I think you just find that your really great leaders self-solve so much more than, you know, than others. And so, you know, you stack something on the top of the, you know, of the stack rank and something else will pop out and you won't care. You won't even know that something else popped out because they just have reallocated so thoughtfully. And then another one is sort of, you know, speed and quality. You know, we added all these people and there's a notion that, you know, you can either go fast or build things that are high quality. And in fact, you know, it's sort of interesting because I think they're strongly correlated. Just the teams that go the fastest build the best stuff. And the teams that go slower, like almost never build good things. So, you know, I think just really scrutinizing your spend, particularly in product engineering, where you spend the most money, is a good exercise to do. We actually now institutionalized this, where every single year, when we do budgeting, the first thing we do is we squeeze. And so we say, what you're getting for next year is you're actually netting down your OPEX spend. So you're going to spend 10% less. What are you doing? And then we sort of reclaim that spend and then reallocate it.
It's interesting.
To teams.
It's like a different zero-sum budgeting, but
yeah. Exactly. And it, you just, you know, it's like building a muscle group. You know, we want people to leave Stripe you know, they get hired to their next job and, you know, sort of bring in the Stripe way of, you know, driving efficiencies and allocating capital. And so we think of this as something we do it every single year. Our leaders will get better and better at it.
In terms of hiring now, the incremental person, I assume there's a lot of scrutiny put on bringing new people into the organization.
Yeah.
Are there certain, I'm sure you guys have your set of values and, and all the things that you hire for, but are there traits that you found in, are they Stripers? What are Stripe employees called?
Stripes.
Yeah. Stripes.
Yeah.
Are there certain, the most successful Stripes that have spiked and risen quickly and taken on a bunch of leadership? Are there certain qualities that you found have just sort of risen above the noise and really solving for those is more important than anything else in a hiring process?
Yeah, there's a few. So one of our operating principles, elevate ambitions. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why people get excited to come to Stripe and stay at Stripe is it's sort of like an infinite problem space. And actually, you know, I always looked for those when I was a VC, like, are you investing in a company that's going to sort of solve a thing and be done, or is just like always going to be more roadmap? And, you know, for Stripe, it's like, you know, I don't know, we have at least a decade more things that we want to build right now that we'll get to over the next couple of years. And so, you know, this notion of just like the bigger vision and where we're going long term and just believing in the company really being able to have macro impact that sort of aligns with the mission of growing the GDP of the internet. So this elevating of ambitions, this thinking big about really being able to do something that's sort of, you know, systemic in its impact is one. Second one, I think there's an Amazon operating principle around this, but so leaders are often right or something like that. I can't remember how it's phrased.
Yeah.
But judgment, you know, it's amazing that you sometimes find that you're sort of micromanaging way down in the org, and then you realize like, okay, I have sort of a problem like right below me. Not necessarily this person's not a good leader, but, you know, why am I having to sort of go around them or so on? And a lot of people who rise quickly are coming up because they've just, you know, without a whole lot of coaching, doing the right thing over and over and over again. And that sort of just entrepreneurial, you know, ambitious and just high judgment execution really helps. And then interestingly, I would say there's something around just a desire to create something beautiful, which sounds a little bit hokey, but a lot of our best leaders are just galled to no end when they see, you know, in our documentation that the string formatting is like different between two different pages. Like, you know, here we use a floating point number with two decimal points, and here we're using, you know, one, and that's like drives them crazy. And I think this is like something that sort of drives a lot of our best users, is we want to, you know, create something truly great for our users.
Are there ways at which you can tease out the judgment thing, or I guess the design appreciation in interview processes, or are those just, hey, those are learned qualities that you see once people get into the organization?
So on the design side, we've actually since changed this, but something I kind of like to bring back. One of our interview questions for PMs joining Stripe was to choose one of several integration paths for Stripe and just do an end-to-end integration. And this is kind of table stakes. You know, I think you can be a product manager at a lot of companies and not really know how to fire up the command line or sort of let alone just making sort of like, you know, curl commands, like build a real integration and have them write, you know, what we call a friction log, which is just what went well at every stage, where did you run into trouble, and so on. And you could see, you know, when people were really opinionated and, you know, just this could be better, you know, there's a sharp, a pointy edge right there, and, you know, or I can't believe you didn't do this. And almost as I can't believe people are the people you want to hire. So you could select for it a little bit.
Yeah. The judgment one's always interesting. I find, at least when we're hiring people to be investors or within our organization, there's generally stuff you can tease out in a resume and just have them take you through how they made each decision along the way.
Yes.
And you learn a lot about people's intuition, their judgment, how pragmatic they are in the decisioning.
Yes.
And if you made a handful of decisions that were, you know, wrong at some point, you're not self-reflecting on why the inputs are.
Yes.
So we try to tease out judgment as much as we can on the interviewing side.
And you want to see that like learning mindset where if you ask them, can you give me an example of when you were wrong or something you failed at? If they really have to search for it and they can't, you know, give you a good, then that typically means that maybe something's off, is too harsh, but you're not getting
it. No, I think it's right.
Yeah.
There's a lack of self-awareness or at least self-reflection.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, that's sort of all we can do as humans, but maybe investors specifically, is just like continue to tweak our mental framework by which we make these decisions.
Yeah, yeah. To the point on sort of, you know, learnings around COVID time, I mean, companies learn by failure or trauma or whatever. And I really think the same is true for individuals. Like I remember, so we run Stripe Sessions every year, which is sort of our, you know, our Dreamforce. It's a little bit different, but it's our global user conference in San Francisco. And John and Patrick typically open it, and then I sort of MC it and deliver a couple of sections, and some of our other leaders, do demos and host some of the sections. I remember in our first one, we had been for a long time negotiating a deal with one of our financial partners that would allow us to geographically expand a lot faster, but it wasn't signed. And in the closing, this sort of like big moment, we're talking about like next year's roadmap, and I made a very, very bold claim about geographic coverage that would be available by the next sessions. And about a month later, the deal fell through for a variety of reasons. And so, you know, fortunately, I don't think people cared enough about Stripe at the time to really notice. But I learned then, like, make sure the deal is signed before you tell the world.
Exactly. You announce it. As you reflect on your now 9 years.
Yeah, going on 9.
Is there something you wish you knew specifically that stands out that, man, if I had thought about that, at, you know, 2015 when I was joining, because Stripe was kind of your first company. You were at Hunch for a little while, is there something from an operating standpoint that you wish you had known in 2015 that you know now in 2024?
I mean, so many things, because just thinking back then, no false humility here, just knew so little.
Yeah, sure. Right? Anything that immediately jumps to mind though, that was like a light bulb moment when you finally realized it?
Yeah, one recent one is, I think when you are designing organizational systems and processes, you have a tendency to design them for yourself or like for leaders. And in some cases, that works, but it's almost never the right design center. The two that are most common are, one, as I mentioned, you know, a second ago, sort of your leaders, like the people who are just sort of you're leaning on to drive day-to-day execution. Or I think the one that people often don't think about is line managers. Because very often, if you want things to get to you, you know, with, you know, sufficient granularity, like you want information to cascade up to you, you need them to be undertaking a certain process all the way on the front lines. And if you want them to undertake that process, you know, with, you know, high sort of, you know, fidelity, they better like it. And so, you know, a lot of what we do to make decisions well and make sure the right decisions are hoisted up in the right ways is figure out what are the mechanisms that, if you're blocked on the front lines, you'll say, oh, I know exactly how to unblock myself, and you do it right there. Or actually, a better example. You want to do capital allocation really thoughtfully. Well, what do you need to do that? You need observability. You need to know what people are doing. Who knows what people are doing? Line managers. So how do you take what's in their heads and what's happening every single week on their teams and get it rolled up to you? You need to create the thing that they want to use to run their weekly meeting. Mm-hmm. And so we spend a lot of time on that. And it's actually part of like spinning up at Stripe. Here's how you do a weekly business review. here's, you know, what it looks like to operate really well on the front lines. Here's all the systems and resources we give you. And then, you know, surprise, surprise, like out of that pops all the information that we need.
Have you guys built something internally, like from a codification standpoint, or is there tooling that you guys use that actually rolls up?
Yeah, actually, we've really doubled and tripled down on it. We have a product internally called Compass. It was originally built just for product development tracking. And actually, it was only recently that we made it mandatory. It had a ton of use already. But we use it for like NPI, new product introduction, initially. And then what we realized was that it could be so much more. And so now we run weekly updates out of it. You can follow projects. It'll send you a digest. You know, all of our product development processes are sort of institutionalized and systematized in it. So, you know, we have various gates towards launch. One thing that we do is something called implementation review. It's like a peer review internal to Stripe. So before you ship your thing to public preview, it has to run through another Stripe, a trained implementation reviewer doing an end-to-end integration, writing up a friction log, saying everything they found. Then, you know, you go through it. You say, what are you going to change? What are you not going to change? Ultimately, there's sort of a rapid decision making. That's the form of decision making we do, where the head of the business unit actually says which changes need to be made. So it's this complex process, and the whole thing just runs through this tool.
Super cool. Yeah. What's the biggest challenge that you're thinking about today for Stripe?
You know, there are a lot of them. One that is persistent but very top of mind right now is migrating users to new versions of our API. We've made, always made the very user-friendly choice, which we're going to keep making, to sort of have a very, very generous end-of-life policy. So basically, if you're using Stripe and you're not sort of trying to adopt more of it, it's just going to keep working. Right now, because, you know, we sort of moved not just like sort of beyond payments, but to this world where we have, you know, this billing suite that, you know, we announced this publicly. It's a $500 million business growing like crazy. And we've got, you know, all these products in Connect land where you can sort of store money in the cloud. We're having to refactor like all of our abstractions because a lot of the guarantees that our API sort of looked at, like if I, you know, process a payment, then all the settlement will come through Stripe's rails, are being relaxed. Like one of the top user asks for billing is, I really want to use Stripe billing, but I have a 4-year contract with TSYS or Worldpay or some other payments processor. So can you like plug that in? We announced this publicly at Stripe Sessions. That's actually now in private preview, so you can do that. But some of these changes sort of run through a lot of our abstractions. So we've actually now cut a V2 of our API, which actually makes, you know, some updates to the API semantics as well. And you know, we are going to have to maintain backwards compatibility. So, you know, if you're a user out there, don't worry. But we also are going to be able to ship so much value so quickly by getting people into new versions. And you know, they're just thousands of lines of Stripe code written into a lot of users. So figuring out how to do that is a big challenge.
Yeah. As you think about payments and Stripe, I guess, in the next 5 years, 10 years, what are some of the biggest changes that you think are inevitable that might be unintuitive to people just going about their day?
I mean, I mentioned it in passing a couple times already, crypto.
In what way?
I'm so excited about it. I'm so excited about stablecoins. So Stripe's history on crypto. So I think it was before I joined. Maybe it was 2014. We were the first major payments company or whatever, if we were major at the time, to support crypto pay-ins, and it was Bitcoin pay-ins. And then we sunset that a few years later. Maybe it was 2017 or 2018, because it was just all fraud, just all, you know, bad actors trying to cheat the system. We lost a bunch of money on it. And it's not surprising, you know, Bitcoin is not a good instrument to make payments with. It's a much better store of value or sort of like long-term asset to hold. And we took some heat at the time because, you know, crypto then sort of started heating up again, and then we sort of jumped back and back in a couple of years later, building a crypto on-ramp. And then, you know, we had this next crypto winter, and I think a lot of people sort of abandoned crypto. And the thing we've just seen as a through line that is just compounding and compounding and compounding is stablecoins. So we mentioned recently that we're shipping stablecoin pay-ins. So you'll be able to, as a Stripe merchant with no integration changes, accept payments in stablecoins. I think it's just USDC to start, but we'll be able to very quickly expand that. And we're now in very recently in private preview. And I think it took 2 days for our cumulative volume in stablecoin pans to pass our cumulative volume over a year and a half or 2 years on Bitcoin. So it is just
and what is crazy. What is the use case for stablecoins?
Yeah.
And maybe a quick primer for people that don't know what stablecoins are, if you could just explain those to.
So stablecoins are just crypto assets that are pegged to a fiat currency value. And you know there are now like Euro rails. I'm sure there's other rails too. I'm sure there's GBP rails, but really USD rails are sort of winning the day. So there's USDC, which is a sort of fully collateralized stablecoin that was started by a company called Circle. A big partner in creating it was Coinbase. And so for this, it's like dollar for dollar collateralized. So in theory, it can't lose its peg. You know, fun fact, it actually did briefly lose its peg when SVB went down because they're storing some funds there. But you know, in theory, it's sort of, you know, securely backed. And then there's algorithmic stablecoins where via trading algorithms, they sort of maintain their peg. So Tether USDT is the most popular stablecoin.
Yeah. And so then, what is the use case that you guys see over time, or how will that change people's experience as you look out 10 years from now?
It's kind of funny because the sort of we were all fumbling around for the killer app in crypto for a long time, and you had the ETH world computer, which by the way is a beautiful vision, and there's like so much value in Ethereum as a platform. In fact, a lot of stablecoins run on top of Ethereum or sort of L2s on top of them. You had you know, all of the speculation that was happening, and you know, Dogecoin and all the other fun coins. Dogecoin sort of the GameStop of stablecoins, I mean, of crypto assets. And it turns out that just the killer app is just money. Like, it's just crypto works well as money as long as you sort of stabilize its value. So many parts of the world just don't have currencies that you can trust. When you look at Southeast Asia, you look at, you know, I think in Vietnam, the adoption of stablecoins is just booming and the economy is actually like taking off there. If you look at the charts, it actually looks pretty correlated. Very young population, very sort of crypto literate. So, you know, for us, you know, part of Stripe's mission has always been to increase the pace of like globalization in commerce, like to break down barriers to cross-border commerce. And, you know, there's a lot of those barriers that exist, you know, that are sort of like written deeply into the existing financial system. And the notion that you could have one globally applicable protocol to program money in the cloud, and you can see how that would get you know, us really excited. So what we're seeing now is that companies that, you know, ship software, you know, B2B SaaS companies, already major conversion uplifts for them when they accept stablecoins, because, you know, if you're in Rwanda, you know, it's, you know, pretty hard to sort of get a you know, electronic payment instrument that Stripe accepts. But, you know, if you can get on chain with stablecoins and you want to buy a piece of software that someone built in India or San Francisco or wherever else, USDC works.
And so now you're seeing this in mostly international markets that have volatile domestic currencies. Is that the primary place that this is unlocking?
I think that's where it'll gestate. And it is gestating quickly. I think it was something like $4.6 trillion over the past 12 months in stablecoin transactions. Now, there's like a Visa report saying that a lot of those weren't actually payments, and that's fair. Like, you know, some of it's probably high interest rates and people just wanting to be in stables because they can, you know, you actually earn pretty good interest rates just from holding stablecoins. But, it, you know, there's a real exponential curve here. And my sense is that the emerging world will sort of normalize stablecoins, and they'll sort of bring all of us who have very stable currencies into the, they'll sort of acclimatize us to the notion that it's a perfectly, you know, normal and well-accepted way to transact. And that over time, like moving between stables and fiat just won't be a big deal.
And you think that the adoption versus Bitcoin, the reason it's growing so much quicker, is that the confidence in the price versus Bitcoin is going to be far more volatile? Or why is it seeing such faster adoption?
I think so. And because it's the performance is a lot better. So a lot of stable coins will run on, you know, L2 chains. So these are sort of chains on top of chains that will batch together transactions to, you know, increase the rate that they're confirmed and decrease the cost of them. And so Bitcoin, you know, there is a Lightning Network, but just Bitcoin in general is a pretty slow and expensive protocol. I think even just on Solana, which is a very popular L1 chain, I think just native on Solana, no L2s, I think it's 400 milliseconds now for a USDC transaction, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah. Artificial intelligence is obviously one of the topics everyone's talking about. You, in prep for this, I went back and listened to a 2015 talk you did at Yale, and you actually said that was the technology that you were most excited about. I think you were even still at Thrive at the time when you were doing that. I'm curious what your perspective has been, both as a former investor and sort of looking at the opportunities that are there, but also as an operator within Stripe of all the AI stuff we've seen over the course of the last 2 years.
Well, listen, it's hard to match my enthusiasm about stablecoins, but I'd say, you know.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, a lot of what's happening in AI is right up there too. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing in 2015 that I was seeing was just deep learning looked like it was really going to work. And so if you believed in, and, you know, sort of continued Moore's law effects, then it just, you know, you would see this sort of exponential improvement in the ability for deep neural networks to just do powerful things for the world.
The video's out there. So yeah. This is not some hindsight revisionist history. The video exists of you saying this. Yeah. So
I will say that was the extent of my prescience. It was very basic. I had no notion of, you know, transformers, even though those were near at hand, or large language models, or just the concept of foundation models in general. I think it's all so fascinating, and I can, you know, talk a little bit about the applications at Stripe. So at Stripe, you know, we've been using, you know, machine learning for a long time.
Sure. And,
you know,
I'm sure fraud detection or whatever.
Exactly,
it's fundamental to the business.
Exactly. Yeah, and you know, we have about something like 100 models, you know, in production to augment our products. There's 43 that are sort of critical, like sort of in the charge path or doing major risk mitigation things. First model was shipped in, I think, 2015. It was like a linear regression model, even how it worked to mitigate fraud. So that's how sophisticated we were at the time. But flash forward to today, you know, I think we've publicly stated that we've been toying with our own foundation models. And, you know, foundation model, basically any large model trained on, you know, large means many different things. You know, for us, it means, you know, order of 100 million parameters. You know, for the GPT ends of the world, it's, you know, many billions of parameters, or you know, hundreds of billions of parameters, I guess at this point. You know, it, you know, with like a sort of self-supervision, so there's no sort of, you know, here's the input and here's the output we expect, and it's actually just sort of trying to take concepts and, you know, embed them in context. And then you can sort of run models on top of that. And this sort of like, you know, this sort of embedding in context is what gives rise to this, you know, word embeddings that everybody uses all over the place and loosely. But just to give you a very simple example of like something that's really working at Stripe, you know, card testing has been on the rise on the internet, maybe correlated with the rise of AI and ML, because it's just easier to, you know, spin up machines to do basic things like this. So card testing is, you know, steal or buy a bunch of credit card numbers and then go to just random websites and perform transactions, just, you know, small transactions to test, does this card work? And then you could sell it yourself or use it for something else or otherwise. And these used to be pretty easy to detect because they would be sort of one merchant and they would spike. It used to be sort of, oh my God, you know, merchant X is seeing a big card testing attack. You know, we're sort of working with them to mitigate that. And, you know, we provide various protections built into Radar, our fraud suite, and so on. We're now seeing some more sophisticated ones where card testers are sort of dribbling attacks across like different sites with just two or three transactions here, two or three here, two or three here. So very hard to detect because no one merchant is really suffering, but Stripe overall is seeing a huge spike. And, you know, that can hurt the sort of, you know, integrity of the ecosystem, violate card network rules, things like that. And so what we found is actually taking just raw payments data. So just take like a giant like JSON blob of payments data. Like here's what a payment means to Stripe, stringifying it, you know, just turning it into like pure text, like tokenizing it, just slicing that up into tokens. And feeding it into a transform model has led to the ability to embed, you know, payments in a way that, you know, is completely unintuitive to a human. We can't sort of point to any single cluster and say, oh, this is exactly why those payments are clustering there, or these are there. But we've been able to identify just in the clustering that happens from these payments, just which ones are more or less likely to lead to card testing. So we just take a new payment coming in. Maybe it's just one of three card testing payments on a site. There's no spike for us to detect. And, you know, this model will be able to tell us in a way that no hand curated features ever could have that, hey, just so you know, that one random transaction that doesn't look suspicious to you is actually very likely part of one of these distributed attacks. So it's been really powerful internally already.
Are you doing that on top of one of the big model providers, or how is that actually like technically working?
So in this case, no, it's actually just ground up our own model. There are we are toying with leveraging some of the existing models to actually do some multimodal embeddings, which we're excited about. There actually are some really cool, like just almost off the shelf applications that have worked very well for us. So one of the things that is a core part of our strategy is to be sort of conspicuously good at risk mitigation and to be incredible stewards and sort of guardians of the global financial ecosystem. We invest just a ton in risk management. And, you know, we just, you know, there was one of our leaders once said, risk management to Stripe is like Amazon, logistics is to Amazon. Mm. Actually, I think it's a pretty good analogy. Like, we just need to be best in the world at it. And there's a notion that, you know, fintech companies are, you know, play it fast and loose, and there actually clearly was, you know, some bad behavior with FTX, and obviously there, you know, this isn't fintech, but, you know, with SVB going down and FRB going down, there's been some tightening in the regulatory environment, and so we've just been doubling and tripling down on risk mitigation at Stripe, and, you know, big banks, sort of do a very good job of complying with, you know, literally with what regulators want. We always want to do that too. And we want to go a step further and just think, how can we be doing this better, like, for the world? And so we built something called Inspector GPT, which lets us do sort of continuous TOS compliance for our users, TOS compliance. There's a lot of different very, very, very idiosyncratic rules about what you can and cannot sell coming in from different, you know, financial partners up and down the stack. So something as sort of scary as, you know, AR-15s, maybe that's not idiosyncratic, to something as seemingly innocuous as CBD. Or actually even more innocuous, like tarot cards. So financial partners don't want you to sell tarot cards. What we've historically done is we've underwritten our users when they're joining Stripe. You know, we use models to do this, like classifier models and so on. And then, you know, we'll review them again from time to time at, you know, different checkpoints. So if they are now hit $500,000 of volume, or, you know, $10 million of volume, or whatever. But we're actually able to leverage sort of commercial chatbots, you know, ChatGPT or Claude or, you know, Gemini. Really, any of them have worked so far. Feed them our terms of service, and just point them at our users' websites, and they just will periodically go and say, "Hey, I took your 25-page, like, super intensive TOS, and I think I found a violation on the 26th page of their product catalog, and it's because this spa, which sells 308 services, one of them is tarot cards." And that violates provision, like, you know, 3A, you know, triple I, whatever, of no tarot cards, according to this financial partner. And just, you know, that's, you know, I think the state of the art for this is sort of like sending humans with, like, the printed terms of service docs.
Sure.
And, like, maybe screenshots, and, you know, having them do this in low-cost locations. And it's just, you know, been really, really impressive, and really, you know, a lot of efficiency.
That I think everyone talks about the human replacement
side
of this, but the superhuman element of it is super cool when you can find that. It's not just, oh, you're making engineering productivity, whatever, this much better. We're automating customer support, so we don't need to hire people in Manila or whatever it is to do this, but actually being able to do things that humans couldn't do, or maybe would be very hard to do as effectively as that, like going over terms of service and being able to catch things on distant web pages.
I totally agree. And actually, one of the things that is that, you know, I've been thinking about a lot on this front is just the sort of, what are the implications for human knowledge, period, of the black boxiness of neural nets and transformers in particular. Just, you know, we don't know how our model was able to tell us that that particular payment was likely card testing. And the model isn't able to explain why it was. Like, you know, there are ways in which, you know, we're sort of getting better at explainability.
And you found it sounds like the accuracy to be
very high.
Yeah.
Outperforming, you know, what we had with hand curated features by a whole lot. And so, you know, there's something deep there about how we need to think about developing our products and enforcing risk standards. Like, if we are virtually certain that the model is right, but we don't know why it is, what does that mean?
Yeah. There's so many moral questions with AI in general, but the potential of bias or whatever, like, it's great when it catches the positive, but the false negative in this stuff when it can't explain how it came to be.
Yes.
And it could be making racist assumptions, or like, totally. You don't know what the primitives are by which it's making those decisions, is fundamentally interesting. How do you go about your corpus of opportunity to apply artificial intelligence is got to be up there for almost any organization. And you also uniquely have the competency internally to do a lot of these things. Yeah. Like, maybe Exxon has similar, but I don't think they have the competency to go execute it on it right now. Not to disparage anyone from Exxon listening, but how do you guys come up with, like, what is worth testing and going after from an artificial intelligence standpoint versus what falls below the line and we should just keep doing it the way it is?
Yeah, I mean, some of this is cultural. You want to, well, I guess there's a couple things. So one is, from a systems and tooling standpoint, you want to just, you know, give people the agency, like the technological agency to start using these technologies. And so we've made a bunch of investments on those fronts.
And that just means having access to
yes.
these tools.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the first things we did after the whole sort of explosion in chatbots with ChatGPT coming out was we just, created a Go link internally. You type Go/LLM into a Stripe computer and it takes you right to an LLM interface. At that point it was just GPT-3. Now you've got GPT-4, you've got, Claude, a bunch of others sort of in there. And we sort of ragged this, meaning we sort of, gave it some additional specific data on Stripe's internal documents. We, purged any user specific data because we didn't want anything, that's sort of native to users to get into these tools. Stripe's documentation it's trained on, things like that, and just sort of gave that to people. Took about 10 days before usage sort of started to level off, and it's actually kind of stayed there. About a third of the company is weekly active, and the vast majority of the company is monthly active. And it's kind of cool too, because we created a community around it where Stripes would sort of share their prompts. So we actually have a prompt now that can take any corpus of text and rewrite it in the Stripe tone. And we are, as I mentioned earlier, sort of really motivated internally by creating something beautiful and being, as we say internally, meticulous in your craft. And so if you're, a sales rep or an SDR, and you just want to make sure you're writing a good email and that it's sort of, it abides our style system and our tone and so on, you can just toss it right in and it'll make some changes and shoot it back to you. Second step was just making sure that from a technical standpoint, we had API endpoints set up to do development with LLMs really easily. And then the third, which just I think goes to product development generally at Stripe, is making sure that you make room for your teams to, have better ideas than you have and surface those. So there's definitely ways that we've been sort of tops down prioritizing our investments in AI, but we also have seen some really cool bottoms up applications.
In terms of like empowering autonomy of decisioning within the organization and just letting people go do that stuff, are there any, clearly it's partially how you hire and what you incent people to do, but are there any forums or means of facilitation that you guys have done, like hackathon days, or it sounds like that prompt sharing is yep. is one, but anything that stands out there?
Well, so in general, I mentioned this in passing, but I didn't define it. So we actually have introduced a formal decision-making framework. And to anyone out there who is like worried about adopting one of these sort of very corporate frameworks, I will tell you it has worked so well. We use one I think was developed by Bain called Rapid, mm-hmm. where you have a recommender, agreeers, input, performers, or I guess inform. I always say input, but it's kind of both. Perform and decide. And particularly given that we don't have titles, this has been very, very valuable for us. So basically any material decision is, you define the rapid. I was worried about sort of the recursive meta decision of like what's the rapid for defining the rapid?
Yeah.
Turns out no one really cares. They just want to know that there's like a formal way this is being mm-hmm. made. We have a decision log we built. A decision isn't real if it's not in the decision log and discoverable and so on. And so, that's how we've like really worked on decision making. It's actually helped a lot. Certain decisions go to certain forums. I make every pricing decision personally, just for like pricing consistency across our entire product base. So we have just sort of various, defined rules and systems. For ML, we have two formal ways we've made decisions about how to invest. So one is we actually do run what looks kind of like an internal accelerator. It's a bit of an experiment right now, but we've been doing it for a couple of years or a couple of cycles. So 1 year, it's called our experimental projects program. And this is just a program. It evolved from what used to be called our crazy ideas program. Crazy ideas program was just we sent around a Google Doc to the whole company and you could write stuff you thought we should do in it. And then we'd read it. Got a little bit big for that. And so now you can apply to just sort of, you know, be seconded onto your own team or a team working on the thing you're proposing for a period of starting 6 months, and then you can keep going if things are going well. And we ran one of those, you know, in particular for ML. So it's just sort of like, hey, we want an entire batch of teams just saying, I want to do this with MLAI, I want to do this. And some of the ideas are things that would be, you know, sort of maybe obvious, you know, Docs AI came out of that. So just a more AI-driven way to interface with our docs. There's some cool ones that I shouldn't talk about yet, but they'll be coming out soon. And then the other was actually centralizing some of how we operate in ML and AI. We used to have a lot of different nodes in the organization. And that's how we ended up with, you know, over 100 models and, you know, some of them performing well, but no shared features across them. And we've now created in what we call our information org, sort of a center of gravity and center of excellence. We hire researchers onto the team. We're actually going to be announcing soon some pretty cool research areas that we're undertaking at Stripe. And this sort of core group is responsible for this like sort of foundation model intelligence layer, where you have the shared embeddings and shared features across everything we do at Stripe.
As an investor at Thrive, you obviously made a very significant and successful investment in Stripe specifically, and then you doubled down on it. What were the things that you looked for in companies or founders or teams? Like, obviously the Stripe investment has proven to be a good one for Thrive and for you at a personal level, but was there specific things that you really sought out when making investments?
Well, I think you're a B2B SaaS investor, so you can discount all of this, but I can give you my framework
time. Yeah, I like it.
You know, when you're an investor, and it's true, I guess, when you're a capital allocator at a company, you're always trying to reduce dimensionality as much as possible. Like, there's just like a million different considerations, like what really matters. And so from a market standpoint, for B2B investments, I always just thought about a simple 2x2 of on one axis, universality, and on the other axis, just sort of core versus non-core. So does everybody need it, or do only a few people need it? And then for core versus non-core, sort of the question is like, do people want the best one?
Yeah.
Are they okay with just any old one? So I used to be on the board of a company, a great company. We use them at Stripe. It's really awesome, called Greenhouse. Mm-hmm. And that investment has gone well for us at Thrive, or you know, former us, now the Thrive guys. That's a sort of a classic like universal non-core, where everyone needs an applicant tracking system, a way to, you know, track the recruiting process. But it's hard to get a lot of pricing power, hard to get really deeply integrated into the company. And, you know, it's just not sort of a core consideration for you know, senior leadership. Stripe to me was just like, you know, the top right of that 2x2, where it's like, what is more core than your money movement? And maybe you needed to have a sense of the vision for Stripe. It wasn't just accept card payments. It was, hey, we're going to be commerce infrastructure for the world. And then everyone needs it, right? Everyone's going to move money around.
And the pricing power you have because of the best of breedness being 0.1% better, or could lead to significant pricing power, because for an individual merchant, that could be material dollars.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's the sociology of payments procurement is very interesting. I won't sort of bore you with that unless you're keen to understand it. But you know, with larger users, the breadth of what you do for them really matters, and they want to see the precise the pricing tied to the value in each dimension. But yes, the short answer is yes. And then for entrepreneurs, and I guess for leaders in general, it's like a good pattern match on when you find someone who just seems to have more hours in the day than, you know, you can possibly believe, that tends to be a good entrepreneur. John and Patrick, I just was struck by how prolific they were.
Probably reciprocally with you going to law school and PhD and all this, they probably were drawn to that on your side.
Failed PhD, but that struck me about them. And the judgment point that I mentioned as well.
One of your responsibilities has been leading product within Stripe. I guess I'm curious, how is Stripe's product organized? How do you think about what is the platform versus mm-hmm. what are the applications that sit on top, or what are the yep. primitives versus, you know, what people get individual decisioning yeah. authority over.
Yeah. And you know, I'll sort of give you the architecture view and then the institutional sure. Organizational view. Cause I really do believe in Conway's law. It's served us very well to follow it. So from a architecture standpoint, you know, Stripe started back in 2011, accepting card payments in the US, evolved a lot since then. You know, sort of phase two was maybe accepting card payments in other countries and then adding in some local payment method support. You know, in Europe, for example, we expanded to relatively quickly. Every country has some local scheme that really matters to payments in that country. And if you don't accept that scheme, you lose a lot of transactions. People are just like, oh, it's only cards I wanted to pay with Ideal in the Netherlands, or, you know, Swish in Sweden or whatever. So that was sort of phase two. Phase three, we started dabbling in other ways of like of money movement. Like it was, you know, just pay ins initially. But then we had Shopify, incidentally, sort of asking to white label our pay-ins API. This is what sort of has led to the really deep partnership with them. And around the same time, we had Lyft. You know, we'd been working with them on payments. And I, you know, as the story goes, I wasn't at Stripe at the time. We were in their office and we saw that their finance team was sort of uploading flat files to make payouts to drivers. And we said, we can, you know, create a better way for them to do that. And so that led to an early version of what we call the payouts API, which is sort of load money into Stripe and send it. And so this sort of multi-party money movement, even though sort of two different paradigms, we rolled together into something called Stripe Connect. And Stripe Connect has been just an enormous driver of Stripe. You know, 13,000 platforms and marketplaces use it today. And it's, you know, it's a very, very significant driver of, you know, vertical SaaS, you know, on-demand economy, things sure. like that. And so this whole thing, like pay-ins, like money storage in the cloud, payouts, you know, converting currencies in the cloud, is kind of what I would call the core business. We call it like a global payment suite, or sometimes refer to the global payments and treasury network. Just basically saying there's all these different ways to move and store money. We have one single API. We can handle KYC for you, mitigate fraud, you know, move money in or out of accounts, and, you know, send it globally. And, you know, we now support, you know, pay-ins across 50 some countries and payouts to over 100. So that's, you know, so the core business that you've probably heard of. 2018, we created something called Stripe Billing. Are you familiar with Billing?
Yeah.
So Billing was originally just this very basic subscriptions API that we shipped, I don't know, way back in 2011, 2012, where you could literally just add a subscription to a customer object in the API, and it would just sort of bill that person on some cadence, some amount, you know, very limited. You could only have one subscription per customer, you know, was not, you know, fit for purpose unless you had the most basic use cases. 2018, we shipped Billing, which was just sort of, you know, a small team doubling down on this, sort of making it a little bit bigger. And it sort of incidentally, I think, you know, B2B SaaS was really booming then and got like a lot more pickup than we expected. And so this whole area of sort of, you know, becoming your billing system and helping you implement your revenue models, track your customers, you know, innovate on your commercial model has become enormous for us and for our users. Is now something like 300,000 users of Stripe wow. Billing and actually growing very, very quickly. And the sort of adage I have is, and this goes for Stripe as well, everyone has a billing system.
Yeah.
Everyone hates their billing system. Yeah. And it's just one of these things where, like, if you've had to work on billing systems, you know, as you hear me talking, you probably feel it viscerally. It's like, you know, your go-to-market team says, hey, we want to rebundle this in this way, or we actually want to pre-bill for this thing or whatever. And you're like, oh man, okay, well, we'll give you that in 3 quarters. And so what we're trying to do is, you know, just take that entire team, you know, allow you to repurpose them, or at least give them a lot more leverage to do what they're doing today. And we sort of rolled this all together with some adjacent services like tax, like assessing sales tax globally, analyzing your revenue, revenue recognition, things like that. This sort of like area between the CRM and the ERP into what we call revenue and finance automation. And this is a major, major sort of bet for us today with billing as the core. And it's a really fun product space. You know, we sort of stumbled upon it to some extent and sort of can't believe that it's as greenfield as it is.
Yeah.
And digging in, we sort of understand why. It's actually really hard. You know, we've had to rejigger our strategy, you know, several times. So there'll be a fun announcement on this in the future, but we've now sort of prototyped our own language that sort of that we'll open source at some point that underwrites all the billing primitives because we need it to have like have certain aspects of static analysis. We also want it to be pretty simple so that you could effectively test changes to your billing system before actually making them. So that's a huge area for us. And you know, there's a few others as well. But these sort of two foundational, or I guess maybe three foundational orgs, core payments, the Connect org, and then revenue and finance automation. And they all sit on top of a sort of product platform org. And that org sort of ties it all together for Stripe. We used to refer to ourselves as, you know, AWS for money. And I think that was just like a very poor analogy. The reason is when you look at sort of, you know, say S3 and Aurora, like, you know, different AWS services, there's no sort of logical tie between them. Like how you model data in one versus the other is kind of like your business, and how Aurora and AWS work doesn't really need to be, they don't need to contemplate each other in any way. Whereas the way that Stripe billing works with Connect and with payments is, you know, needs to be, you know, graceful and subtle. Hmm. Like if we model Logan as a customer in payments, then how our invoicing API thinks about, you know, a sort of credit balance for you as a customer in a different product line needs to cohere.
Hmm.
And so this platform org is very important, being sort of the sinews sort of tying it all together.
And so are there discrete leaders for each of those functional areas, and then the platform underpins it? Or how does like engineering resources get allocated and like functionally, how does that work?
Yeah, so each of those are unit organized. Payments org, Connect, we actually call it money as a service, revenue and finance automation. And then we have the platform org also unit organized. So product and engineering, other embedded functions in each of them.
Hmm, interesting. And is that the way it's been for totality of time, or like how has it evolved?
So one thing we've done is we have hoisted more technical unification upwards. So it used to be that you had sort of the classic, you know, Amazon phalanx of, you know, just sort of unit orgs all the way down. That didn't work very well for us.
Because of the need for interoperability.
Exactly. Spot on. So we've hoisted that upwards. So you typically have, you know, one of these very, very, we don't have titles, but, you know, some SVP, EVP level person with a head of engineering in each of those areas.
And so then when you're starting a new project, like you referenced billing was kind of, I don't know if skunk works is a fair term, but in the early days, it was kind of a small group that got going, similar to the Connect product. Sounds like that was smallish in the early days. How do those things manifest themselves? Like, do you just sort of send some people in the wild and say, have at it, and sort of see if there's traction behind it? Or is it more top down and telling people to go try these things?
Yeah, you know, we've had the benefit, and, you know, I mentioned this before, of like the sort of infinite problem domain. Had the benefit of just vehement user demands for us to expand into different areas. You know, good examples, Stripe Tax, you know, just every year will Patrick or, you know, someone will tweet out, you know, what do you want us to build next year? And tax was just rising to the top of the list. And so we decided we're going to shoot off a team to go work on that. You have the classic questions of like capital allocation where, sort of never makes sense from a near-term ROI to spend money over there versus shipping the things that your large users want in the core. So you have to protect them for a while and so on. But usually we have a few gates for each of them. But typically they're non-speculative bets. They're just sort of like, you know, what you need to go execute.
Sure.
Maybe areas like, you know, when we brought back crypto a couple of years ago, it's a little bit more, at least that time speculative. Now it feels very non-speculative, but yeah, then it was.
One of the things I heard you say is that companies are often hesitant to force an ROI calculation for early projects. Can you elaborate on that point and why thinking about ROI is an important thing in the early days of building products?
I guess my more specific push is just that, and actually I'll kind of parrot John Collison on this, but we work in an industry where fiscal discipline for the winners is just not that important. You know, maybe it was very important to Amazon in the early days, but you know, with Meta and Google, you know, just soon enough, ads money is geysering out of the ground. And so, you know, they're not always the best run companies from the standpoint of just precision around how many people should be doing this thing. Do we know what they're doing? What's our observability into the growth there? You know, how can we think about the incremental benefit to investing more? And then as you grow up as a company, you end up bringing leaders in from these great companies because of like the survivorship bias of that's where the leaders are. And so this skill set of being really, really disciplined with your resources and thinking about that ROI and self-solving, just typically, you know, the sort of leader products don't ship with that feature. Mm-hmm. And so you want to really, you know, drive it home.
You made a comment earlier about titles, not having those specific titles. I guess I'm curious, there's this Mark Zuckerberg view on titles, which is that they're very expensive. And there's this Mark Andreessen mm-hmm. view of titles that they're very inexpensive. Mm-hmm. How do you think about titling within Stripe and the cost of giving out titles?
So I'll caveat this. That I've always had a title at Stripe, so you know I shouldn't be one to talk. But we
good for me, not for thee.
Exactly. Yeah, we get various pushes to introduce titles to Stripe. You know, I think that there's a few reasons to do so, and a few reasons not to. And I just think about it very pragmatically in terms of like costs and benefits of it. And to date, just pragmatically, the costs seem to still outweigh, or the prospective costs seem to still outweigh the prospective benefits. Culturally, I think it's actually quite good not to have them because it just speaks to a pretty flat culture. And, you know, just they introduce just semantically a notion of hierarchy that, as I hear it, at least from Stripes, we don't have. And I think it's part of that. You also end up, you know, in a situation where, you know, it's actually not just titles. We don't expose levels internally. So, you know, if you were level 6 and I were level 5 at Stripe, you know, officially I wouldn't know that you were a higher level than I am. Now, I might know because people talk, but the sort of second order sociological effects aren't there, where the average person doesn't know that you're a 6 and I'm a 5. So maybe I don't care as much. Mm. Whereas if you're a senior director and I'm a director, then that's just apparent and everyone knows it. And it just is sort of, you know, I think maybe can lead to bad incentives. You know, a lot of times also, you know, the more senior title is correlated with a larger scope and a bigger org. And we all know there's very bad incentives related to that. On the positive side, you know, we've been a big push over the past couple of years on decision making, and I do think that it gives you a language for decision making. It's like this is an SVP level decision,
sure.
This is a director level decision, so on. And actually, maybe a subtle benefit of not having them is just people don't know how to mine your employee base. Mm. People try to mine Stripe's employee base a lot.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so some of the considerations.
In terms of like org chart design, then is the org chart exposed internally, and so are people able to de facto back into levels of responsibility? I realize headcount is not a perfect proxy for that, but
yeah, we've made a big effort to sort of create divergence between, you know, sort of where you are in the org chart and your level. And so you have You have some people who are line managers, who are some of our most senior engineering leaders. Typically, they report in pretty high.
There's some ways of getting
kind of back into it. We do expose the org chart, and it's very useful. I actually really believe a lot in org design, you know, far more than I used to, but it just maybe it's a part and parcel of growing as a company. But actually, this came up at a Q&A for the whole company on Friday around, like, what are we doing to make sure we don't ship the org chart? And, you know, to me, that question is very little. we're going to ship it. It better be right. There are certain mechanisms we have to sort of tie things together, as I mentioned. But we kind of put the org chart front and center, so you know how it's structured.
What have you learned about, like, org design, I guess, now that you've reflected on it? And are there any... Is there a takeaway or any, like, insights that you wished you had known in the early days?
Maybe the thing that comes to mind is not any particular time where it was grossly off, but I feel like I've learned that the sort of incantation that companies reorg too often is probably literally true, but sort of spiritually off. You know, I think there's a Toyota design principle or whatever they're called. There's one around continuous improvement. Mm-hmm. And I really think if you are operating in this continuous improvement mindset, and if you're, you know, growing your ambitions and building new things as quickly as, you know, we want to be at Stripe, there's sufficient change that, you know, you're probably not, if you're not changing your org chart relatively regularly, you're probably... you know, sort of actually destroying productivity. So you're sort of like always weighing the benefits of, you know, organizational stability against the benefits of sort of really being organized against your new strategy, your new goals, and so on. So I typically think about any org change we make as having, you know, a life cycle of 12, maybe 18 months at the outside. And then there's obviously like pruning you'll do and sort of gardening you'll do further down the org chart, you know, on an ongoing basis.
Do you guys still do metrics roulette within product teams?
No, not formally.
Really?
Not formally.
Maybe explain for people what it was and why the principle behind it.
So we used to do, I think this was one of my bad ideas. We used to get together at our sort of leadership team meeting. This was a 30-person meeting. I think it was every other week. And we had a little script that would just choose a team and a leaf node team, like a line managed team. And it would choose them the day before. And he was just using Unix rand command or something like that to generate a random number. So every now and then a team would get picked, like, you know, twice in 4 weeks, which was they did not love. And they'd come in and just, you know, present their metrics of, like, you know, here are the four metrics that we run our team on, and here's how we measure success, here's our targets, here's where we are against them, and so on. And so in theory, it was a good mechanism because you would know that it could be you on any given day and sort of encourage you to really be on top of your metrics. It's like three things that I think were problems with it. So one is, you know, this sort of, you know, panopticon design of, like, you know, you can't tell whether or not we're staring at you, so you better be on your best behavior. I felt a little culturally off. Felt a little infantilizing, I think, to people at times. Two is that we actually sort of were looking at metrics kind of at the wrong level in terms of, like, the leadership team to leaf node teams. And what you actually really wanted to happen was your reports or their reports sort of ensuring that they have the right WBRs, and, you know, those may be cascaded down.
WBRs,
weekly business reviews. Weekly business reviews. And so, you know, you would end up having this sort of, you know, junior team to central leadership team conversation that just, you know, I think kind of disempowered leaders and didn't really have the right types of conversations. And then the third one was just, when you have 10 minutes to do that, and it's a team that you know you don't have like deep expertise working with, you actually just couldn't give very good feedback. And so we did that for a year. And actually a different mechanism, and one that I think is actually working quite well. So are you familiar with a guy named Alan Mulally?
No.
So Alan is a leader I find very inspiring. So he was CEO of Boeing, one of their divisions. I think they're sort of like aeronautics division, or I can't remember what the exact name was, but longtime Boeing executive. And then he became the CEO of Ford, I think in 2008 or something like that. And you know, at this point, Ford was teetering on the brink of bankruptcy already, huge problems with unions. It was sort of the laggard of the big three at the time. I think the stock price in his early tenure dipped down to like $1 or $2 a share. And by the time he left Boeing, Ford, which was 7 or 8 years later, stock price was in the high teens. You know, I think it peaked around $24 later. He had something like a 99% approval rate with the union members, which was crazy. And they were the only one of the three major car companies that took zero federal money. So pretty just incredible guy. And I read this story and I was like, man, I got to figure out how the hell this guy did this. And so he has like a system. He calls it the working together system. And, you know, I sort of, you know, just like with Toyota or other great companies, just stolen little parts of it. But one thing we do now, which, you know, I'm just raising him because I have to credit him with some of it, is every other Thursday, the top, 80 or so leaders get together and we run a meeting called the Run the Business Review. And it's a 2-hour meeting. So 1 hour a week that you're dedicating to this. And we go through every single budgetary line item, and everyone has a set of initials. It's the owner. And every single company OKR, we have about 82 of them. And everyone, red, yellow, green, if you are green, you can actually skip it, give commentary if you want to. Yellow means you have a plan to get back on track, but you're not on track, and we talk about that plan. Red means you're off track with no plan. And so we do this together every other Thursday. We do a QBR once a quarter too. What I found is this meeting is sort of the right level for collaboration among leaders. If you're red for 3 weeks in a row, we jump out to what we call special attention meeting, where the right subgroup gets together to talk about how are we making a plan to get back on track. And I always find like organizational design mechanisms, like if they're good, they'll be fractal. Mm. Like you'll find that, oh, if this thing is working, I'll start to see it happen down below in various places. And this is actually turned into sort of an operating model for the whole company, where, the leaders will have their own RTVRs that sort of happen, 2 or 3 days before, and everything sort of rolls all the way up to this meeting. Mm. So I found this has been much more empowering of leaders, maybe a little less scary for line managers. And it's been working well for 2 years.
Mm. How many like metrics or things are on that, that graph? Or
so budgetary items that actually have targets is probably about 30.
Okay.
Then we have 82 company KRs. There's whatever hundreds or thousands of KRs that teams track, but there's 82 track centrally. We also have a top 10 among those. And 82 seems a lot, like a lot, but it actually works out to be about one per 120 employees. And if you're a 120 person company, presumably you'd have more than one. So I don't know, seems like a good number.
Yeah, totally. If you were still doing venture today, do you think you would have gravitated to doing AI? Like, would that be where you're spending your time, or do you think you'd be off doing something totally different?
I mean, I think you have to be, right? It's just setting aside whether the current crop of companies are going to be wildly profitable or wildly unprofitable. There's all the sort of, obvious jibes at inference costs and so on. Just a lot of things are going to change.
Yeah.
I mean, you can just tell. And so I think whenever the world is on the precipice of changing as much as it is, I think you can't ignore it.
Yeah. You've worked now with John and Patrick for 9 years, and I think people hold them in Well, I guess before you made the investment, what, a year before that or 2 years before that?
A year before, yeah.
A year before. So 10 years now, 9 years as an employee. What's something that people don't appreciate or maybe is less appreciated about those two, either of them, I guess if you mm-hmm. want to call it out separately, although they tend to get grouped together, that maybe people don't appreciate that aren't working as close to them?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to appreciate. I mean, obviously they're extremely intelligent. Maybe doesn't get talked about that much, but extremely tasteful. Like, just one of the core things that makes Stripe is a sort of level of taste that's hard to teach. But the two that, you know, sort of struck me when I was first getting to know them that have really been borne out over the years is, one, they're very kind. Like, they're kind, humble people, and I think that keeps people at Stripe. You know, you're just not working for jerks, and so we've had a lot of our just senior most leaders have been around for a long time, and they're very wise. You have great judgment. You sometimes you just, you know, at least I do. I think, have you guys seen this before, and you're just not telling me? And I think that's probably correlated with them being very curious and just having a lot of conversations who have seen it before with people who have seen it before. But that's what jumps out.
Yeah, interesting. Are there, you mentioned reading, studying Toyota and studying some of the stuff related to Boeing and Ford's turnaround. Are there other leaders that you've looked up to or been influenced by outside of Stripe, like just people in particular that you admire or have taken principles from?
Well, one I know you talked to was Claire yeah. Hughes Johnson. Stripe would not be Stripe without her. And I sort of consider her in many ways to be perhaps my only personal mentor. And
she was COO for...
Yeah, she was COO. She started a year before me, 2014. I think she was there until 2020 at some point. I think just her understanding of organizations and people and how they work, her intuition around, you know, what's really going on and why, you know, something's not working, was amazing. I encourage anyone to read her book, Scaling People, I guess it's called. So definitely her. Marianne Lake, who's now runs Chase, but who was at JP Morgan, was a really good sort of mentor in my early days as a CFO. Just seeing the rigor that she used to run JPM. You know, she's sort of bouncing between talking to regulators and doing capital allocation, doing product reviews. She comes to mind. I'm trying to think about other leaders I've spent a bunch of time reading about. Oh, a good one, actually. Frank Slootman.
Yeah.
He impresses me so much. And there's just clearly a formula, right? And it works. One of the things he says that I like to repeat a lot internally, particularly being someone who has sort of grown up on the product and engineering side, is that sales is reality. He proudly calls his companies sales-led companies. And I think in my early days as CFO and CPO, I just spent a lot of my time on all the cool stuff we could do. And then you go sit in the room with the customer, and what they want to talk about is completely different. And the reality of whether or not your product is what they want it to be is right there in the room. Like, you're talking to them about, will you pay more for this thing? Will you buy this thing? Will you move off of XYZ to us? And so I think his approach to being very sales-led, it leads to a customer centricity that I really like.
Are there any unpopular opinions that you hold or anything within... they get espoused as Silicon Valley truisms that you find to be untrue?
I don't know if this is an unpopular opinion or not, but I feel like VCs get a hard time. And take all the politics out of it. The venture industry sometimes gets, people talk about how venture is dead and, you know, it's just a reverse auction now in terms of pricing and no one has pricing power and blah, 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 and so on. And that everybody knows the hot deals, and there's like romantic notion of, you know, how Oracle was discovered by being in the same office park as Sequoia or something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but Larry Ellison was working nearby, and that's how how Oracle got funded. You look at a place like China, where you had this venture boom. I think 2018, you had 50,000 startups backed or something like that. I think this year it'll be maybe below 1,000. Yeah. It's literally gone down by 98%+. And so, you know, just the culture of being enthusiastic to back entrepreneurs. I would rather have a system where companies are systematically overvalued rather than undervalued. Mm. And so I feel like there's sometimes this notion of, you know, the persnickety longtime VC saying, ah, valuations these days. And I actually remember saying the same thing in like 2013, right? When, you know, valuations were a fraction of what they are today. And so I just, you know, I think the venture industry is just one of the most core engines of growth for, you know, the US, for the world. So maybe it's a uncommon view, maybe not unpopular.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree wholehearted with you. I remember there was a very prominent VC that publicly retired on Twitter. This is now 3 or 4 years ago. And the person said to, like, valuations are just too out of hand, and I'm stepping away. It's just not enjoyable anymore. And it was funny, if you deconstructed the investments they made implicitly, this person probably made $500 million personally off of low valuations. And I was like, of all the times you should be investing, and maybe they were even right with the time, but I was like, you in some ways, you could say, like, took advantage of entrepreneurs at lower valuations back then. It's almost like you owe a service to continue playing it through, not taking your ball and going home, especially since I think it was the person's personal capital with it. I think there's been this meme that I think was largely true 10 plus years ago, that probably some high percentage of VCs were a little tone deaf, and the founders came to them, and they were masters of the universe because they had access to the purse strings of capital. And I think that whatever that ratio is a far smaller percentage than it is today of people just waking up and trying to do their best to invest in founders. And it's certainly a lucrative business if done well. And so no one should feel particularly bad for any venture capitalists out there. You don't need to start a hug your venture capitalist campaign or anything. But it does feel like it's the meme has kind of outstripped the reality at this point, which I think is a good thing. I don't know. All the jokes led to self-awareness, which I think, or cancellations, as this case may be.
Yes, exactly. And that's true in any industry, for sure. And so it's not a sort of, like you say, a blanket hug for every venture capitalist. But I just think that we sometimes deride the industry when, in fact, I really think it is something that makes the world great in many ways. I remember probably 2010 or 2011, you know, one of the VCs I look up to the most, Jeremy Levine, who I'm sure you know from Bessemer.
Yeah, did a podcast with him.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Amazing. I should listen to that one. He's
incredible.
Saying much more interesting stuff than I
know.
But he, I think we were at Balthazar just up the street, and I remember him talking about Toby from Shopify, and just talking about how, you know, he had this founder who every board meeting just surprised him in a new way. And this would have been around the time that Toby was, you know, getting started with Shopify payments and plugging payment systems into Shopify. And Shopify went public, you know, I don't know, maybe a few years later at a valuation of 1.something billion.
I think maybe lower. It was either 1.1 or 900. It was something like that.
Right? Yeah. And now it's a, you know, whatever, $100 billion company.
It's amazing.
And so, you know, to that end, valuations needed to rise.
Yes. For sure. What, I guess as we wrap, what keeps you motivated today?
Well, for one, it's still fun. And that's the most important thing. Just, you know, does it get you out of bed every day? I think a lot of people who I've talked to in my career, you know, predicted I would have founded a company by now, but I love what I'm doing at Stripe. And, you know, there's just always something new. Back in 2020, we were about a year and a half into Stripe Billing, but it was still a bit of a you know, a toy project with a handful of people on the side. And we were talking to Atlassian. And, you know, Atlassian, amazing company, you know, cobbled together in some ways via a bunch of acquisitions, almost like a holding company for a bunch of different SaaS services, doing an amazing job of like cross-sell, cross-subsidy, and so on. As you can imagine, their commerce system was tricky because they're billing for Bitbucket in this way and Jira in this way and Confluence in this way. And we thought to ourselves, like, what better way to test you know, billing and its future applicability than to take them on as a customer? And so, you know, if I just think about the evolution from that moment in 2024 to today, you know, working with, you know, RSIs and GSIs on selling, you know, the billing integrations to hundreds of thousands of merchants, it's a fun 4 years. Mm. And I just see many more in the future for Stripe. I think people talk a lot about AI as a disrupting technology. They also talk about it a lot as a sustaining technology. As you noted a little while ago, we have some of the most interesting data in the world. And I think there's a lot of ways we can leverage that data to advance the mission of growing the GDP of the internet. Capital, for example, Stripe Capital is, we're finding just that when you can get a small business a loan, it actually helps them grow and grow sustainably, which is sort of amazing. Hmm. So Stripe Connect, as I mentioned, is our product for a complex money movement for marketplaces and platforms. One place we're seeing just really amazing growth is our Connect users selling, well, not selling, providing loans to their users via our sort of programmatic capital API. And so I'm really excited to see what, you know, what what foundation models, and I guess LLMs is more of a, you know, everyone thinks of chatbots. It actually is really just about autoregressive transformers, but what they can do for underwriting. Mm. And can we, you know, 10x the applicability of credit? So I just find, you know, there's a lot more fun to be had, and looking forward to you know, the next 10 years.
Yeah, well, good. Well, thanks for doing this. We did a full podcast and no question of when you guys are going public. So.
Appreciate
thanks,
that.
Bill. Yeah.
Thanks, Logan.
Thank you for joining this episode of The Logan Bartlett Show with President of Stripe, Will Gabrick. If you enjoyed this conversation, we'd really appreciate it if you press subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on, as well as share with anyone else that you think might find it interesting. We look forward to seeing you back here with another great guest on The Logan Bartlett Show next week. Have a great weekend, everyone.